When in the lair of the pale man, remember not to eat or drink anything from his table. That doesn't apply to coffee, does it? Especially if he has sparkplug coffee, because sparkplug coffee starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that they deliver this exceptional coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. And hey, they even offer autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee and be forced to resort to stealing from the Pale Man's banquet. And now Sparkplug is offering a special deal to Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT, all one word, the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. The promo doesn't apply to any of the gear they sell, but it does apply to any size coffee order, and you don't have to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hola, movie likers, and gracias for inviting the Next 100 Project into your day. We used to be the AFI Top 100 people. Now we're just the movie reviewing people. And we're also the spoiling people. I'm the weird creature who sits at a table covered by an uneaten, sumptuous feast, Ryan Ellis, and here's my grape-stealing scamp of a wife, Bev.
That's me.
Stop stealing grapes, you rule breaker. The coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Pan's Labyrinth. Is Guillermo del Toro better when he directs foreign language films or English films? Another opinion piece. We've had so many of them in the last couple months.
It is now that I confess with embarrassment that I have never seen any of Del Toro's other Spanish language films. In fact, I've only ever seen this film, Blade 2, and The Shape of Water. So with limited knowledge, I have to say that, yes, his Spanish films are definitely better.
Going with the internet opinion, I guess, right?
Well, with my opinion of the three films I've seen, the best one is by a country mile, Pan's Labyrinth.
That's
so
true.
Therefore, his Spanish language films are better.
Pan's Labyrinth, The Devil's Backbone, which was before this one, you should see that, and Kronos, which was a mixture of both English and Spanish, and that was before all of those, also worth seeing, versus Blade 2, which I liked quite a bit.
Me too.
Hellboy 2, which I prefer to the first Hellboy, and now The Shape of Water, which is in theaters right now, and people are raving about that. Those movies are pretty even keel. Actually, it's pretty tough to say what the better group is. Probably the foreign language films. But there's also the mediocrities like Crimson Peak, Mimic, and Pacific Rim. And that's why he's thought of as the guy who, when he directs Spanish language films, great! When he directs English films, okay. If he only ever did those English language films, he wouldn't be thought of as a great filmmaker. He'd be Eli Roth or something like that.
I'd be curious to see what his take is on this. It's my assumption that it would be a lot more about the Mexican filmmaking system versus the Hollywood system. I mean, Mexico has produced some of the greatest filmmakers of this generation.
Two of his best friends, Alfonso Cuarón.
And Iñárritu.
They were on Charlie Rose. It's one of the DVDs I've got, or Blu-rays. I forget what movie it is. The three of them were promoting movies in 2006. This for Del Toro, Children of Men for Alfonso Cuarón, and Babel for Iñárritu, all on that show at the same time, talking about what they had done already and what they wanted to do in the future. And I looked at the future of cinema in some ways, certainly foreign language directors getting into Hollywood. This movie, Pan's Labyrinth, was subtitled by Del Toro himself because he didn't trust them to get it right because they'd gotten it wrong in, I guess, his previous films and certainly other movies before. Every once in a while, I will watch a movie that's in French or Spanish or whatever the language is, and I'll know just enough to think, that's not what that person just said. So maybe he was right to not be trusting. So yes, I think we're taking the typical internet opinion and saying the foreign language films are better. But if you just look at his top two or three in each category, foreign language and English, it's a lot closer than you might think. And even though we didn't love The Shape of Water, we liked it, that does raise his profile a lot for a lot of people because a lot of people love that movie.
Done very well this year.
So the Next 100 Project's 91st película, am I saying the right? Película film, isn't American, so it couldn't be nominated for any AFI list. After being shown at Cannes and TIFF and other festivals, it was released at the very end of December 2006. Considering it was a disturbing period piece with subtitles, ticket sales were pretty good for this picture. Bev, explain what the movie's about with the skinny!
The last gasp of the Spanish Civil War provides the backdrop for this seductive fairy tale where Ivana Baccaro, Baquero plays Ophelia, a little girl who discovers that she is the reincarnation of an underworld princess, and she must perform various challenging tasks to earn her readmittance into the magical realm. She's guided by a mysterious fawn, but distracted and waylaid by her ailing pregnant mother and her vicious army captain stepfather, who has his own mission of rooting out and destroying any remaining members of the resistance.
And we shouldn't neglect to mention that the army captain is played by Sergi Lopez, one of the great villainous performances of modern history in any movie.
He's a little mustache-twisting, I guess, but he actually plays a pretty believable psychopath.
I wouldn't say mustache-twisting at all. I think he's pretty believable. I think he's a great villain in just general. He's so vicious, but I find that to be realistic in this kind of movie. So, in a nutshell, Hallucinator moves to the countryside and things go very badly.
See, there's a point of argument. Is she or isn't she hallucinating? Point of debate.
There's a very key shot in the movie right towards the end.
I know what you're talking about.
Where Vidal, the army captain, Sergi Lopez, sees her standing talking to no one. But of course, she's supposed to be talking to the fawn. Now, is that supposed to signify that he can't see the magic? And maybe adults in general? Because this is one of those movies where adults can't see or they don't want to listen to it. The mother, early on, when she first gets there. Oh, forget it, Ophelia. You're silly. I don't care about your magic stories. We do see the fairies in a shot where Ophelia's not either present or watching them. So in movie language, that suggests they're real. It isn't just what she's seeing. But then that's a very key moment towards the end where you see her looking at nothing, kind of like in Fight Club, where they cut to Norton looking at nothing in the hotel room when Pitt's talking to him. Even though they're literally saying in that movie, I'm not real. But they make it very clear in that movie that he's not real. In this one, you can take it however you want to. But I like the angle that maybe the fawn is real if it had been someone else looking, but not this sadistic asshole bastard murdering guy who's about to shoot her dead.
Well, Ophelia is Princess Moana, which is why she can see the fawn. And I would say that the key shot comes shortly before the scene you're talking about. The real key shot that tells the audience that her hallucinations are actually real is when they're running through the labyrinth, she hits a dead end, the captain is right on her tail, and then the walls part, like the Red Sea, and let her in the center, and then close up behind her, while the captain, you know, comes running up, and then just hits this dead end, and she's gone. So magic saves her in that moment. Well, sorry, it doesn't save her. It buys her some time. Mm-hmm. Enough time to complete the last task, in a manner of speaking, before he finds her, and the fawn lets her die, because that is the point. Now, I always interpreted this movie that she dies at the end. This whole thing is her fantasy, her beautiful fantasy. Yeah. The film opens with a story about a princess who escapes her magic realm to go to the world above, where she dies. Like, the movie tells us immediately that Ophelia is doomed, and she begins the movie by reading fairy tales, this very story, so that could be the basis for the fantasy that she goes on to indulge in while she powerlessly watches her mother die, and they're both at the mercy of this evil Captain Vidal. And I think the crucial shot at the end where they show the three thrones and she goes to meet her real family in the underworld, the film shows that scene and gives that narration, and then shows Ophelia's body losing life. She's dying, the blood is coming from her nose, and she smiles and takes her last breath, and then that's the last time we see her. So you could believe that the underworld scene is just a fantasy that Ophelia is indulging in as she's dying. Except for the shortcut in the maze. And as you said, you see the fairies that she doesn't see. Also, we don't know how Ophelia gets into the captain's room. The chalk door thing doesn't let her in.
To kidnap the baby.
I think that's like film language telling us that it's real, and Guillermo del Toro has said there really is a magic realm. He said it's real. She didn't die. She is Princess Moana. All of those things really happen. In a way, the fantasy world is just as cruel as the real world. The fawn doesn't care if she lives or dies. He just cares if he gets the real Moana. He just wants to bring balance back.
Because life in this world means nothing for her. In fact, I think I read this somewhere how del Toro says, the tyrant's reign ends with death, but the martyr's reign starts with death. So that's why she gets to go to this kingdom, and she is a martyr. She is the Jesus figure, saving the brother. What's the point? She has to know she's not going to get away with it. Realistically, Vidal's going to track her down, and she must know she's going to get killed for taking the only thing that matters to him, this kid. Why is he so obsessed with a son? I think there's a few reasons for this. One, he's got daddy issues. The watch from his father, kind of the gold watch in Pulp Fiction, I guess. But it's the whole thing about, this is my dad's watch. It's so important to me. But then he also is a captain, which is not nothing, but his father was a general. So why does he want a kid so much? Maybe to further his own legacy and try to make the kid even better than him, or maybe he has to be better than the kid. Maybe he knows his days are numbered at the end of the Civil War, that he's in this outpost. And then when Mercedes cuts him repeatedly, multiple places, he's bleeding out. Yes, of course, the face thing, which everyone remembers from this movie where he sews his own face shut after that Joker-like smile he has. Forget that. The other stab wound she gives him, he's probably going to die soon from infection or just from blood loss. Maybe he knows all those things are true, so he wants this son to live because that's the only thing he has left. Even when the movie starts, and they've already been there for a little while, he's been in charge of this outpost for a little while, maybe he realizes then he's not going to live much longer either. So he has his own destiny, his own fate, he thinks. But because he's a tyrant, as Del Toro says, his reign is over. Right down to Mercedes saying, your son will never knew you existed.
The greatest death line. Your son will never even know your name. Oh, such a satisfying thing to say to him because he's such a bad villain. So my theory about why he's obsessed with having a son, of course he's very arrogant, but he also has a total death wish. When you see him chasing the rebels in the forest, he's not trying to protect himself. He's not hiding behind trees like his soldiers are. He's just walking straight towards them, pointing a gun, shooting, shooting, shooting. He only lives because he's lucky. He fetishizes death and talks about having an honorable death, dying with your boots on.
Like Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump.
Yes, actually.
Die on the field with honor!
I think a lot of soldiers probably have a death wish. I think a lot of people join the army because they have a death wish. But there's a pretty important scene when he's shaving in the mirror, and then he's staring at the mirror, staring at himself, and he's inside a room. It's the mill, but it looks like the inside of a watch. You know, there's the gears, and the watch, of course. He's obsessed with his father. He's obsessed with this sense of legacy. And he holds the razor up to the mirror where his throat is and imagines cutting it. So I think he wants to die, but he can't die because he's so arrogant until he has an heir, much like his father did. So he wants to do what his father did and be a great man, and that's what that great man did.
Maybe so much about legacy. Okay, we've gone away here. We haven't done the basic numbers we usually do earlier on. So the Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 95% of critics like the movie. That's a pretty good score. 216 fresh, only 12 rotten. And 91% of audiences. The movie's also 130th on the IMDb 250. And it was 82nd at the 2006 U.S. box office. Pirates 2, meaning Dead Man's Chest, was number one. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. And the Best Picture winner that year, The Departed, was 15th. The actual title of this movie, translated properly, is not Pan's Labyrinth. It's Labyrinth of the Fawn. And that makes more sense because it's always called the Fawn. I don't know what Pan's has to do with anything. Maybe they're trying to play off Peter Pan? I don't really
know. Well, Pan was like a goat god, right? He was like a half man, half goat god. And the Fawn definitely has like goat-like features. Mm-hmm. But he's not Pan. Pan is a specific character. And Del Toro has said, no, he's not Pan. He's a different thing. So it's almost like a mistake of the translation. Although the phrase Pan's Labyrinth kind of rolls off the tongue much nicer than the Labyrinth of the Fawn. Mm-hmm.
Maybe the studio was reluctant to call it Labyrinth of the Fawn also because then the first word is the same as a David Bowie movie and they're always worried about crossing over and conflicting with something else unless they want to literally steal from something else. I don't know. It's kind of dumb.
Maybe they're worried that everyone, if they hear the word the Fawn, they would think that it was Fawn, like a baby deer or something. Like they wouldn't put it together. They don't give American audiences a terrible amount of credit.
Yeah. Well, this was supposed to be the second in a trilogy about the Spanish Civil War, Devil's Backbone, which is a brutal movie by, and I don't mean in a bad way brutal, but a brutal movie by Del Toro from, what would it be, the late 90s? I forget what year it was now. But that was a good movie, and you should see that for sure. But there's been no third movie in this trilogy yet. And this movie, by the way, Pan's Labyrinth, has a theme of threes.
Yeah, he said that was connected to fairy tales. Fairy tales always rely on the rule of threes, which is common in writing altogether.
Mm-hmm. And the end is the beginning. We see Ophelia dying in the very beginning of the movie. The blood goes back into her nose, though, so it's like it's saying, we're going to rewind this and then come back to where we were. We've seen that in so many movies where you might see the very end of the movie at the beginning and then you catch up. Or maybe a lot of times what actually will be is the middle of the movie and then you see that scene later on, then you continue on. But then this movie, it's the end and we don't know why. And because it's some actress we've never seen before, some girl, you don't necessarily remember that you saw that shot in the beginning when you get to the end, the first time you see the movie, because who is Ivana Baccaro to you, or Baccaro, or whatever her name is. Getting back to Captain Vidal, because I think he's the most interesting character in this movie by a mile, even though a lot of characters are really good and interesting. The captain is right to be paranoid about traitors because he's surrounded by them. The doctor and Mercedes and everyone really around him, you can't really trust any of them. But he is a bad guy, so whether or not he's being betrayed, the question, of course, becomes, how did he really woo Carmen, Ophelia's mother? Did he woo her at all? Was it a rape? And did he kill her first husband?
Oh, he definitely killed her first husband.
Well, the movie doesn't make that plainly clear. We believe that.
Yeah, I think the movie makes it clear enough that he killed Ophelia's father.
But did he rape her? Was it more a matter of a coercion, that kind of thing?
My interpretation, and of course I'm just like assuming from what they give us in the movie, that husband dies, she has no idea he has anything to do with it, she's destitute, she's totally screwed without her husband, and suddenly this hero swoops in and says, I'll take care of you.
Harvey Weinstein. I'll give you the role if you fuck me.
Well, he doesn't just... He marries her. So she could be like, oh, how lucky. This man wants to marry me and he's going to look after
An
me.
An army captain, which should be a future for her financially and security-wise.
And the craziest part is he really just wants a breeding mare. Like
yeah, she's the baby factory for
yeah, sure. He picks her, I guess, because she's beautiful, because she's already had a child, so you assume, okay, good, she's good to go. And we don't know if she was pregnant when he married her either. Maybe he knocked her up first to make sure it was worthwhile. But they are married, so she could just think that he was her savior. Like, oh, how lucky for her that this man came along and wanted to save her from destitution.
Makes you wonder if she hadn't died in childbirth, if he would have let her die or killed her or what have you.
Oh, he probably would have let her raise his son. It's not like he wants to change diapers, I'm sure.
Yeah, he just wants the benefits of the son, not actually having to do the work for a son. He doesn't have long to find out, because it's only supposed to be a matter of hours or days after she's dead that he's dead, and everything at the movie comes to a head. One of the more important scenes in the whole movie is when the captain and Carmen and a lot of guests, including the doctor, I believe, too, are all sitting around having a big dinner. They're talking about others, meaning the nobodies, basically, having to ration food while they're enjoying a glorious feast. And then an unsubtle comparison, great comparison, though, is the Pale Man thing in the fantasy world. The dining room layout is very similar. The Pale Man with a stigmata thing with the eyeballs and the palms, it's a Jesus reference, I guess, again. But he also hurts children rather than saves them. The Pale Man thing is freaky and weird, and if I was younger and saw this movie, and by the way, this movie is so not for kids, although I think a lot of people thought it was in 2006, and coming off the heels a couple years later of Lord of the Rings, which is one of the reasons this movie got greenlit, for sure, the Lord of the Rings, fantasy movie, giant success, Oscar winning, all that stuff. So Pan's Labyrinth has really nothing to do with Lord of the Rings, but it got greenlit definitely because, in part because of that. But people take their kids to see this movie, and they're going to be horrified by a lot of things, but one of them is definitely that Pale Man scene where it's ripping the heads off the fairies and coming after Ophelia and almost gets her. Were you scared by that scene the first time you saw the movie, or even this time?
Yeah, he's creepy. Not only is he creepy, but the moment where she's eating the grapes, if there is a moment in any movie where I have more wanted to jump inside the screen and stop a character from doing something idiotic, it's stopping her from eating the grapes. Like, why are you doing that? Of course I know why she's doing it, just because the plot requires that she make this stupid decision. Her mother sends her to bed without dinner, so she's hungry, and there's this gorgeous feast there. And may I add, the feast is there, but he's not interested in eating it. He wants to eat children. He wants to eat fairies.
The folds of fat hanging down are because he had been obese but hasn't eaten in a while. That's the logic that Del Toro talks about in the commentary.
Yeah, he said he designed the face to resemble the underside of a manta ray, which he always found creepy. But yes, he himself had experienced some weight loss, used his own skin.
Like Del Toro had.
Yeah, his own skin, his own body, the way his body changed, and exaggerated that to create the Pale Man, and his legs are like one of the creepiest parts where it's like skin and bones, but there's so much skin flapping around. It's such a creepy, beautiful, amazing design. And Del Toro has said straight up that Pale Man is a straight stand-in for predatory white male supremacy. After Trump was elected in 2016, Del Toro said, I don't know if it was in a tweet or an interview, the Pale Man is thriving now. You know?
The orange Pale Man.
Yeah. And he also said that his preference for eating children over the feast in front of him is an interpretation, at least someone has interpreted, maybe it's Inuritu who interpreted it as a criticism of the Catholic Church. But definitely, like, the powerful white male is what he represents. Somebody who has everything and still seeks to destroy. But damn, that scene is scary. And the tension when she's running away from him, trying to get away, oh my god, it's so well done.
Trying to draw on the ceiling to get out of there.
Do not let children see this movie. And I hope children, if they made the mistake of seeing this movie, I hope that they were dissuaded by this scene before they got to later scenes in the movie that get way worse. Because the stuff that happens in the real world is actually quite a bit more disturbing than far the fantasy worse, stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's impactful violence.
But sticking with this scene for a minute more, does she damn herself when she eats the grapes the way the Fawn says she does? And she does pay later by dying, at least in the real world. She dies off, even though he gives her one more chance. But is she damned anyway? Kind of like Moses striking the rock in the middle of nowhere in the Exodus story, so he doesn't get to go into the land of milk and honey because he made one mistake.
But she's not, because she gets to go to the kingdom at the end of the movie.
If you want to believe that fantasy realm, I suppose, yeah.
Then, okay. The Fawn gives her one last chance.
Speaking of the Fawn, by the way, I love the cool effects, and they show this on the making of stuff on the Blu-ray, DVD, all that, that removed Doug Jones' actual legs to give the Fawn its weird legs. This guy, Doug Jones, has been in not all Del Toro movies, but most of them. Certainly recently, he was in The Shape of Water as the, what do they call him, the Aqua Monster, or what they call the thing.
I know, yeah, the Swamp Monster.
And he was Abe Sapien in the Hellboy movies. He's been in most of the movies that Del Toro's done that require these kinds of characters. And he's very good at playing these kinds of characters. He's the Andy Serkis of specialty characters that aren't motion capture, I guess.
Yeah, like of makeup. The physical actions he takes when he's wearing the costume of the Fawn, his feet are in what looks like an extra joint, and then there's almost like an extra part of his leg there, but he is standing in these kind of weird adaptive.
He can walk around uncomfortably, but walk around normally, but then they green screen or blue screen, whichever it is, out his legs, so he has the Fawn type legs. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't exactly a comfortable thing. It's a big, heavy outfit he had to wear, which is true about most of the outfits he's had to wear in Del Toro movies. He's also the Pale Man, so he's both those characters.
I had the good fortune this week of going to see this exhibit at the Art Gallery of Ontario, Guillermo del Toro's The Realm of Monsters or something. I can't remember exactly what the exhibit's called, but it's a lot of stuff from his films and a lot of his art collection and curios from his house. But I got to see close up these beautiful recreations of both the Pale Man and the Fawn. Not to be gross, but even like his penis, his pubic hair is moss. And he has this little branch looking penis, and there's so much beautiful detail, and it goes beyond to a lot of his other movies as well, and the design is just out of this world. Del Toro is such an imaginative creator. He almost reminds me of Miyazaki. First of all, he channels the minds of children to build his worlds. He seems to have this access to the childhood id, but also his worlds are just filled with these unnecessary yet beautiful details, just layers upon layers of thoughtful design. And the costume of the Fawn is just out of this world. He designed the Fawn, both in the script and the way he looks. He said, he's kind of creepy looking. You're not supposed to know throughout the film whether he's a good guy or a villain.
He's pretty aggressive sometimes when he talks to Ophelia, too.
And his voice and his face, everything about him, you think, oh, Ophelia should not trust this guy. First of all, she'd be terrified of him. He's very scary looking. He just kind of looks like this steampunk demon villain. They set you up to suspect him. Especially when he says, bring me your baby brother. You're like, oh, here's where it goes. Del Toro said that the Fawn is supposed to have no allegiances whatsoever. He is impartial, just like Mother Nature. He doesn't care if Ophelia lives or dies. He's just there to shepherd the moment. So he isn't good, but he also isn't evil. Do you also notice that at the beginning of the film, the Fawn is old, he's brittle, he has gray hair.
It's like he rejuvenates as he goes along.
He gets younger as it goes along. And Del Toro said that's because the closer Ophelia gets to death, the younger the Fawn becomes. Mm. He like feeds off
almost
of
like
her
a
youth.
Vampire.
So while Doug Jones performed it also, he didn't do the voice performance. He doesn't speak Spanish. He performed it phonetically, but they used a voiceover actor to actually do. Yeah,
I read he had to learn Spanish well enough to speak his lines. Maybe that's what they meant, so they could dub him over later. But then you don't see his mouth moving, so I don't know. Is that right? That he didn't have to speak?
So they said it did help. He does speak, and he does move his mouth. It was definitely helpful that he learned his lines phonetically, and he apparently worked really hard on it. Probably disappointing for him that they wound up dubbing it, because he apparently spent hours and hours every day with a voice coach learning how to phonetically say all of his lines. And in the end, they just got this stage actor to do it. But I'm glad they did, because his voice performance is so good. Mm-hmm. He has such a cool voice, and there's so much, I don't know, he's so sinister. Like, you just sink your teeth into that performance.
David Hyde Pierce dubbed him over as Abe Sapien in the Hellboy movies, too. And I don't know if he loved that too much, but they wanted a more famous voice, I suppose. David Hyde Pierce had been a voice in A Bug's Life, so he had experience doing voiceover work. Let's talk about the real-world violence, because as we said, that's definitely worse than what we see in the fantasy world. The rebels in this movie are fighting a lost cause, and even they know it. Because they even say, if Vidal dies, they'll just send another one to take over his place. Now, they do win at the end. The movie's suggesting that not only does Vidal lose his life by getting shot, and not only does he lose his son, well, he takes his son, okay, fine, but he's killed his stepdaughter. I don't know if he really ever adopted her, but he's murdered her blatantly. It's one of the reasons why this movie shouldn't be watched by kids. His wife's died earlier, doesn't seem to care that much about that. Then he's shot dead. But even before any of that happens, they've taken over. So, yeah, maybe they'll lose this battle, and they seem to know they probably will long-term, but Vidal is lost for the time being. But we see him cut that dude's hand right down the middle, which is a gross visual. We see him shoot that doctor in the back walking away when he's finally realized for sure the doctor's part of the betrayal. Schindler's List-esque. Bang. Now I don't have to think twice about this. You're dead.
Probably the worst murders he commits are near the beginning when he meets the farmer and his son who have been rabbit hunting. And the way he kills the son right in front of his father, just smashing, what is it, a bottle or something? He's just repeatedly, but kind of methodically, bang, 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 right in his face.
It's a knife, isn't it?
You're killing him, you're killing him. No, he's beating him to death.
Okay, well.
And his father's screaming and it's heartbreaking, and then he shoots the dad and just takes out a whole branch of a family, totally innocent people who were genuinely rabbit hunting. And his reaction when he sees the rabbits, the evidence that he was wrong, but them being a part of the resistance.
Search more thoroughly before you come bothering me.
Yeah, and bothering me. Like, the worst thing that happened was that he was disturbed, tells Mercedes to cook the rabbits and calls it a day. It's so cruel. It's so matter-of-fact. It's the banality of evil right there. Because you're right, he's not a mustache-twisting villain. He's so evil that it perhaps could be interpreted as a little over-the-top, but he's not a villain who takes joy so much as it's just like his job, and that's almost scarier. He's so completely unaffected by the violence that he commits that makes him so terrifying. And you know he's capable of hurting Ophelia. As much danger she faces in the fantasy realm, you feel as an audience member,
her days are numbered.
This girl could legit die. Like, you are very scared for her welfare. And when her mother is dying in childbirth, and there's this scene where her and the captain are sitting in the hallway but waiting to hear if her mother's going to live or die, and if her baby brother's going to be all right or not. And they're sitting there, and all I can think is, if her mother dies, she's left at the mercy of this monster. He isn't going to want anything to do with her. She's simply an inconvenience. If he thought he could get away with killing her, he's not going to think twice, which is exactly what happens.
Although he would say his motivation, because she's taken his son away, whether it's her brother or not. You're taking my son? Fuck you, you're dead.
And chances are, if none of that had happened, he probably would have just sent her away to a family member, found somebody to deal with her, and never really thought twice about her welfare.
Yeah. It's such a dark movie, though, because if you think about the real world stuff, nobody really wins. The rebels have won for the time being. They've killed Badal and most of his men, probably will kill all of his men or capture them if they have to, but then someone else is going to come. The Spanish government's not going to let this stand, and Ophelia's family, well, her brother, I guess, is alive, but she and her mother are both dead.
One of the saddest things about this movie is that we know, because of history, the captain's army does win. They do succeed. The resistance ultimately fails. Franco and the fascists ruled Spain for decades, like for a generation, until I think the 70s or 80s.
Generalissimo Franco. All right, well, the cast, we've talked about them plenty already, but Del Toro has never cast anyone from this movie other than Doug Jones in another movie. Now, maybe he still will. Nobody's career is over just yet. I don't know why he didn't use Sergio Lopez again. Maybe he didn't have a good role for him. I don't know.
Well, he hasn't made a Spanish language film since this, has he?
Could be. Maybe that's part of what it is. Although he could find a role for these guys. Anyway, the point is he hasn't cast anybody else other than Jones. Ivana Baccaro. I don't know how you say her name.
Baccaro.
The disobedient girl. She's only been in 10 movies and nothing else really stands out like this one does. Does she invent all the fantasy elements as a way to cope with her horrible reality? Now, we've talked already about whether or not it's real or fantasy, but if you want to go down that pipeline, you could suggest that this is a way of coping.
I think the movie is inviting you to interpret it that way.
Sergio Lopez was in Dirty Pretty Things, and he will be in Terry Gilliam's The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, which is finally getting made after all these years. That great documentary, Lost in La Mancha, was made about the attempted first try at The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. I'm not sure who he's playing. I didn't write that down.
I thought that he was actually just making Don Quixote. Is that the name of the
book? The Man Who Killed Don Quixote is what Gilliam called it back then and now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. If we were going to talk about acting nominations from this movie, for sure Lopez, I would say, in the supporting category.
I would also say the little girl who plays Ophelia is one of the best child performances I've ever seen. And he said he really wanted to cast somebody younger, and for whatever reason she read for the part. People were crying in the room when she was auditioning. He just said, oh, to hell with it.
They'll adjust the age.
He rewrote the script a little bit differently to accommodate. He wanted like a six-year-old. I don't know, when you find an actress like this, you change the movie to fit her. And thank God, she's not even just an excellent actress. She has a great screen presence. She's beautiful. I mean, she's 11. She's a really, really pretty little girl.
Hasn't had a lot of roles that I've seen that are all that relevant since this. Maybe in Spanish language films, they were big deals, but I don't recognize the title.
Well, she's probably just in her early 20s now. So
just coming into her own. She's
still in school. You never know what the situation is with child actors.
Sometimes kids don't want to be actors and they don't want to. Just give it up on it. Maribel Verdú, who is so sexy and tragic in Alfonso Cuarón's Y Tu Mamá También, is Mercedes, and she's pretty tough in this movie. She is the one who, I guess you could say, kills Vidal before he actually gets shot, because he's going to die of those wounds, I think. Ariadna Gil is the mother Carmen, who'd been in Belle Époque in Appaloosa, the Ed Harris movie, which was a few years after this one. And then Alex Angulo plays the doctor, who goes out like a true rebel, dying in the dirt and the rain. And that reminded me so much of a death you might see in a Schindler's List type of movie, because of the fact that he's just so undignified, but the way that people die so often. That great death scene in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, where Keith Carradine is just trying to be a nice guy and gets shot dead and falls over in the mud or in the water. Well, also in Shane, actually, maybe a better example. That came long before any of these movies. The farmer stands up to Jack Wilson, gets shot dead in the mud, and that's the way deaths happen in reality, probably far more often than some awesome standoff where you die with your boots on. Well, they literally die with their boots on, but you know what I mean. The writer, director, producer was Guillermo del Toro, who did, of course, movies we talked about already, Blade 2, Hellboy, Hellboy 2, The Shape of Water, which is just out right now. He refused the Hollywood wooing to make the movie in English because it had to be in Spanish, and I think that was the right choice. And he essentially did the movie for free. He gave up even back-end points to make sure it got made.
Wow.
There's that great story that's online, I've read this many times, about how he lost his infamous notebook, something he would sketch things like probably the Fawn and probably that character in Shape of Water that Jones plays. He probably drew that 10, 15 years ago, finally puts in the movie. He lost it, and then a cab driver found it and made sure to get it back to him, which is a really sweet thing that guy made that effort, realizing how important it was to whoever owned it.
And I saw that notebook on Tuesday. As part of the exhibit. Oh, it's
there, really?
Yeah, behind glass. They had a couple, because he has more than one. They had them open, but you could flip through a little tablet thing to look at other pages. He's an excellent artist.
Isn't it too bad he didn't actually direct The Hobbit and the sequels, because...
Oh, totally.
Peter Jackson didn't want to do them in the first place, and Del Toro did, but they took so long that Del Toro eventually quit. I'm not sure if it was with bad blood. He's actually credited as a writer on the film. I think he may have executive producer credit. Well, anyway, he's a writer for sure. But he was supposed to direct the first one, and I guess all of them that they were going to do, and then he eventually bailed. It's a shame, because it might have been better. It probably would have been better.
It would be darker. I think it would be better by our taste, because we kind of prefer things that have a little more edge, that Except are a little darker.
Jackson's Lord of the Rings movies were unbelievable. I still love them to this day. I don't know why. Well, that's
just it. Most people would disagree with us and say they're perfect the way they are. Do you want Doug Jones to play Gollum rather than Andy Serkis? Because that's probably what would have happened.
Now, he would have found a role for Jones, not as Gollum, I don't think.
You don't think he would cast Jones as Gollum? It seems like a no-brainer. In the
Hobbit series.
Yes. Oh, in The Hobbit, right, not...
That's what Del Toro was going to do, is The Hobbit, not Lord of the Rings. So that's what he was supposed to do, and it's unfortunate he didn't do them. The producers were Alfonso Cuarón. So yes, his buddy was one of the producers on this movie, and then Bertha Navarro, Frida Torres-Blanco, and many others. But Cuarón's the one that stands up the most. I wonder if maybe that's how they got Maribel Verdú, because she'd been in... Y Tu Mamá También. I watched the scene in that movie, by the way, where she seduces, what are their names again? Not Gael Garcia Bernal. What's his name again? The other guy is, I forget his name.
He looked like he was going to be as big a star as Bernal, but he drifted off.
He was in Milk. Well, I mean... Anyway, when she seduces him, he comes in the room with a towel and nothing else after a shower looking for shampoo, and she just tells him to fuck her right there. And the way that plays out, I watched that again not that long ago. It's a fucking hot scene, man.
I gotta see that movie again. I haven't seen it in so many years.
And knowing her backstory as well through the whole movie, where she's doomed too. Just like Ophelia in this movie. We don't know that till the very end, that she was always doomed when they go on their little trek. Yeah, Cuarón, Del Toro, and Iñárritu, a lot of their movies are about doomed characters that either know it or don't know it, and some pretty dark stuff.
These three directors, they do not pull their punches. All three of them, and all, maybe not all of their movies, but it's a recurring theme in their movies. Nature is cruel, and man is cruel, and humans are fragile. They go places that Hollywood films typically don't. And for some sick masochistic reason, I just love it.
Pan's Labyrinth was 185-1. We watched the Blu-ray, which looked pretty damn good. The cinematographer... Who won an Oscar? Guillermo Navarro, who usually works with Del Toro. He also shot Jackie Brown, the Tarantino movie, and he did the Twilight finales. Well, there were two of those, right? Breaking Dawn 1 and 2?
Yeah.
What a weird bunch of movies here. Jackie Brown, this, and Twilight. But the movie does look very good. This one does. And the editor, Bernat Villaplana, It's got some interesting transitions, this movie. A lot of those where you see the fantasy or the real world going between each other with a pan through black or something like that. Pan's Labyrinth. Eh? But anyway, he also cut Hellboy 2 and The Impossible, the Naomi Watts movie. I assume you like the editing.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. I think this movie's near about perfect.
But not nominated for its editing. It had 6 nominations, but not for that. The music was Javier Navarrete, who did music on The Devil's Backbone, a Del Toro movie from many years before, and Wrath of the Titans. Ugh. Did you notice the recurring theme of la 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 la? I can't do the music. Anyway, it sounds a lot like the Rosemary's Baby theme, but it's supposed to be Mercedes lulling her, and Ophelia, that is. And yeah, I think it's Rosemary's Baby-esque. Probably
well, also based on a lullaby, right?
A real lullaby?
Song you sing to a child. Well, no, okay. But I'm saying Rosemary's Baby is about a mother and a baby, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so they're both kind of lullaby-ish.
Is Ophelia the devil's baby?
Well, she is the princess of the underworld. So in a manner of speaking, you might say that.
I didn't think of that till now. Mm-hmm. Well, other influences are, of course, Alice in Wonderland and The Wizard of Oz. Some fantastical themes are shared by all these movies. The Labyrinth and the reference to a hedge maze and also The Shining, which also had bad dads, murderous fathers. The Shining is a movie that people refer to more often than we think. It comes up fairly often in the podcast we've done about how it's an influence on other films that aren't necessarily anything to do with Shining material.
For a movie that was trashed at the time it came out, it certainly has proven itself to be a very influential property that people still care about a great deal. Let me tell you, because I did some Christmas shopping not that long ago. If you type in the words film art into Etsy or Redbubble, The Shining will be on the first page in spades. Mm. It's a very influential, it was a very impactful movie.
And The Shape of Water has a similar, quote-unquote, happy ending that's actually tragic. And you pointed that out when we left The Shape of Water about how it's not really a happy ending if you interpret it the way it probably should be interpreted.
I am a killjoy. When I read the thing that Del Toro said, oh no, she really is Princess Moana. She really actually is alive at the end. She shuffles off this mortal coil, but then her spirit goes
alive is
the
a weird world. Word for it.
Sure,
she lives on or something.
It's in a manner of speaking tragedy that she dies, but the audience knows that her spirit actually is going to carry on and live in the kingdom where she truly belongs. I was so disappointed. Strangely, I don't know why, I like that movie so much better. And he invites people to interpret it however they want. He's like, I left it somewhat vague on purpose because I do want people to see what they want. But in the Rorschach test, that is how I interpret movies. I always go with the dark interpretation simply because for some reason that's what I prefer. So I see The Shape of Water, I'm like, she dead. And I see All Is Lost, I'm like, he's dead. I always want it to be the darker version. I feel like that makes a better movie. I don't know, I like movies that really just dig deep into the violence and fragility of life.
And how is Sally Hawkins going to live on underwater with this creature? I guess it's like Splash, maybe, where somehow the character who doesn't have gills can live underwater forever because of love or something.
The movie has magic, so it's not out of the question that her scars become gills. Oh my god, spoilers on The Shape of Water. It's not out of the question that you could have an optimistic ending to The Shape of Water. I think I just always choose the pessimism.
People told you to bring tissues to that movie, but neither of us cried when it was over.
It didn't even come close to moving me to tears. I liked it a lot, and it really won me over by the end. And even before it won me over plot-wise, there's just so much to enjoy about it. Sally Hawkins, as usual, is absolutely amazing. Michael Shannon, maybe a little too much.
He's the Sergio Lopez of that movie.
But he really is twisting his mustache. There's some cool stuff in his character, but I just found him as a villain.
He's a good actor, but he does lay down thick in most movies.
I like the subtext about his family and the American dream. It's absolutely worth seeing. I don't want to discourage anybody from seeing it now that I've spoiled the ending, but it was a very good movie that won me over, but...
But calling it a happy ending is probably not accurate.
Yeah.
Okay, Pan's Labyrinth's awards section. It won 3 Oscars, cinematography, the sets, and the makeup. Pretty good wins there. It also was nominated for the script. The only nomination Del Toro's ever had at the Oscars is for the screenplay for this movie, although he's probably going to get nominated for at least one director for Shape of Water, but we'll see. It's a little ways away. And also the music and the foreign language film nomination it had, but it didn't win. The Lives of Others won the foreign language film that year, and I think that's a good choice, but this was the better and the correct choice.
Yeah, I don't like Lives of Others, but you do. Just about everyone else I know who's ever seen the movie loves it. But you'll agree that Pan's
Labyrinth. I just said, this is the better choice. Yeah. Not even close. It's like when we did Amelie, and I said No Man's Land won the Oscar that year. And that's a very good choice, but the better movie, the one that's lasted longer, the one that that people care about more by a mile, Amelie, Pan's Labyrinth, over those other two.
Yeah. Great nomination for the script. Talk about 10 for difficulty, this script. What he did blending a fairy tale with this very violent and terrible event, the end of the Spanish Civil War, and even taking a fairy tale and making it a grown-up fairy tale can so often just mean adding sex or something. This is truly an adult fairy tale that has components of violence that are very grown up, but still, like I said before, has this highway to the childhood id, has this way of just getting right into that magical thinking part of our brain and blends the two in a way that I don't know if I can think of another movie that does it this successfully. And again, I bring up Miyazaki, even a very different filmmaker, he also has this way of channeling that childhood brain. Even above and beyond that, the intricacies of the plot and the characters and their arcs all blend seamlessly and beautifully with great dialogue. This is truly one of the greatest scripts of that decade. It's one of the best films of this century so far, there's no doubt about it.
All right, well then, last thoughts on your second choice in Bev's month, third annual month of Bev, I should say, Pan's Labyrinth.
Well, 11 years later, I'm still totally blown away by this film. It's aged amazing. I think it's going to be a classic forever. I just think it's this heartbreaking, breathtaking masterpiece.
It's a strong choice, and it's not an easy film to watch, especially when you see that guy's hand getting ripped apart and begging to die with the doctor getting shot in the back, Vidal getting stabbed, his face getting ripped open, sewing his own face shut, and then the booze he drinks, it comes through the little wound. So many great touches. This movie should be almost NC-17. It's so violent and so brutal.
How about our hero, a little girl,
getting shot dead?
Gets shot and dies at the end. Mm. That's NC-17 right there.
Mm. But it's a great choice, and it's a movie I'd not seen in a while, so I was glad to see it all over again. Okay, well, we're off next week because we'll be sucking in sunshine south of the border. In fact, we booked our trip about an hour before we sat down to record this podcast. The Ellises are overdue for some vacation time, but when we return on January 29th, we'll conclude the month of Bev, and we'll douse you with an artsy and surreal masterpiece, Lars von Trier's Melancholia. So the coming attraction trivia for Melancholia. Can anyone think of a more bleak ending in history than what happens in the final moments of Melancholia? Another opinion piece, but holy shit, does it get any darker than what happens in this movie? And if you haven't seen it, we're going to spoil it by suggesting it gets bad.
Yeah, it happens in the first few minutes of the film, the end of the film, but from a different perspective. Does it get bleaker than that? That's an excellent question. And for the answer to that, please check out our next podcast about Melancholia. And if you just can't wait that long to hear from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. We've covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, but in exchange for all of these free, wonderful podcasts, could you just give us a rating, write us a little review? If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. Once more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it is not case sensitive.
Okay, as great as this movie is, it was harsh. Next movie's gonna be harsh. Let's go get some sun down south. Bye!
Bye!
See you in 2 weeks!
And cut!